Philip Bourne, a little bit about your family and your family's names.
Well, do you understand that?
Yeah.
I was born in Lithuania, a small town.
Well, do you know, remember the name of the town?
Dagda.
Was that near Vilnius at all?
No, it was near what they used to call Dvinsk, about 30 or 40 miles from there, in a very small, it would be a village, a small town it's mm-hmm. called. Name was Aronoff. Very best girlfriend was born in Vilna, mm-hmm. and she was telling me the experiences of the 1905 abortive revolution. And she was right there in the street, it was in a big courtyard, I guess, when the Charles police started shooting at them. She told me she hid under a fence.
How old was she at the time?
Well, it probably was something like 12, 13, mm-hmm. little girl.
Mm-hmm. What year were you born?
Oh, in the early 1890s. I really I'll tell you about my family. We had the. I never knew my birthday or the year I was born, but I know it was in the 90s sometime. The reason I wasn't registered because we had a registrar who used to drink a lot. And there's always those people who had money. At that time, service in the army, the army was 4 years. It would be a tragedy for a Jewish boy to be in the army. So those who could afford would give the registrar a pint of whiskey and he'd have the whole thing out.
So anyone else who was listed also was
And my older brother wasn't there either. And he began to worry that he has no birth certificate, no registration, that he'd be a vagrant, that he'd be arrested or something. So he got himself over to Canada. That's how we're all here, our whole family.
What was your family's name?
Aronoff.
A-R-O-N-O-F-F.
Oh, double
F. Oh.
Yeah.
And what were you the youngest child?
No, I was the fourth one of a large family. And it's too much to talk about that particular life in that town. It was a struggle to survive, especially for people who had large families. It just was not enough.
What sort of work did your father do?
Business, some sort of business, mm-hmm. one thing or another, so trying to make a living for the family.
So how many children were there altogether?
Altogether we survived 9, but we were 10.
So you had 11 in the house?
We had 11 in the house, plus some nephew of my father's who came from the countryside to stay, because they had to go to school. There was no school in the villages. And we had no public schools either. We had the school, Jewish school.
Because the Jewish children in Russia weren't allowed to go to school usually, were they?
Oh, yes, they are. But they had to be in their own schools. And so the boys were educated. Once they were educated in the Hebrew and in the Yiddish, they were also educated in some of the languages of the city, like Russian. Of course, at that time there was no Lithuanian language. They talked among themselves in their own language. But the school language was all Russian.
But in your house, did you speak primarily Yiddish?
We spoke Yiddish. So, that's the way.
How large was the Jewish community in the town?
It was all Jewish community. It was what they called the Pale settlement, mm-hmm. just in the Pale. And it was a few non-Jewish, you know. But it was all Jewish community, and we had all the Hebrew teachers were around my neighborhood, all the synagogues too, they were around my neighborhood. I used to hear what I heard, and I would observe, I knew.
Your family wasn't Orthodox?
They were Orthodox. Mm-hmm. What they call Hasidim?
Oh, they were?
Yes. Father was
the Von Hasid.
Well, he had his beard, but the long faces he didn't have.
Oh.
He took good haircuts.
What sort of business did he have?
Well, we had a little store that mother used to take care of, more or less. And he was spent a lot of time in the study house. He was studying Talmud all his life, I guess. And in the winter, the peasantry was very poor around our neighborhood. So he used to come into town from about 10 or 15 miles around, I don't know how they were, and bring whatever they could to sell. I remember when I saw in the paper they killed so many cows. they used to bring in the cows but a week old and sell them. But my father used to buy them, some of it, and have the ritual.
Was he a shepherd himself?
He used to get a shepherd to do that. And he'd cut it up and sell it. That was part of our butchering. So that was part of our livelihood. And in the summertime, we would have packs with some dairy people who had farms outside of the way out of town and bring the milk in and we'd work at it and sell it. So we were a busy household.
Did the children all help in the store too?
Well, they were too young, I guess, to help in the store. My father used to after he was through prayers and all that, he'd go to the store. And then when the town burned down,
was there any pogroms?
We heard about it, but there was no pogroms in our town. I know the boys used to organize and self-help groups. But we thought that it'd come, but they used to come in on a Sunday from the villages around. And we had this monopoly, what they called, Greeks was all monopolized by the covenant.
Uh-huh.
They used to come in and spend their money, get drunk and fight. It was a horrible, horrible day Sunday was.
These were all goyim who were
there? All goyim. And yet, my father knew a great many of them because he used to write letters for them. They were all illiterate. And I remember my house used to be full of smoke and the yard would be full of horses and buggies with their home woven blankets covered the horses. Never forget a picture. And he would write letters for them, so much a letter, 3 cocks or 5 cocks, something like that. They would dictate it.
And he'd write in Russian?
In Russian, yes. Yeah, there are people who learn one language, learn the language of their town, of the country.
Hmm. Now, when the peasants used to come in then and get drunk, then
they wouldn't, those people that come into our house, right, to their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw them drunk, no. But the people, the young people, I imagine, is in the marketplace. There's a one square marketplace where all the stores were around, you know.
So there was a fair amount of anti-Semitism then?
The people that I knew were not anti-Semitic.
Because you mentioned that the young men organized this.
Because we heard about it. You see, we heard about the pogroms. It was a horrible thing to hear about it. We had no newspapers in our house, but we heard about it.
Of the pogroms
in the cities. In the cities, yeah. In Kiev and in Mohyliv, or whatever they call it, Mohyliv. And where else was it? In the big cities.
Did they actually arm themselves then?
No, just sticks and stones. Arms. Whoever saw arms in those village. But one thing that impressed me very much was that it was said that when the pogroms would go on for days and the priest would get so fed up with it, he could bring out the images of Christ and the Holy Mother into the marketplace that would quiet the rioters down.
Huh.
They were conscientious priests there too. Mm. But it was all Catholic, anyway, all Catholic neighborhood.
Oh.
There was probably one or two, what they call the Orthodox Sarajevi. And I used to see them praying, saying how funny it looked when they say one sentence and kneel down and go way down with their forehead. It looked so funny.
So did you go to school at all then, there?
I didn't go to school until I came to this country and went a couple of times to a couple of seasons to reading school.
Mm-hmm. Now, did anyone in your family come before you, or you
were
the first to come?
My brother was the first to come because he, as I said, he had to. He was afraid.
What year was that he came, do you recall?
Let me see, about 1905, 1906. Okay. And he was working very hard, and at those years you would buy a ship's passage on payment. So he bought a ship's passage for a couple of us. And then I was the third group that the kid, my brother and I came over in 1908, I guess.
Mm. Oh, so the first brother came, then he sent money back first.
Right.
The second.
to the second his younger brother and oldest, our oldest sister.
And then you came with
and then I came with my youngest brother.
I see. And how old was
he? He went to school. He was a youngster. He must have been about 14, now 16. And I went to work.
You came over on your own?
Yeah, we came with just the two of us. Yeah, also because my brother sent the money for us to come with.
Where did your boat leave from?
Well, that's what I was trying to remember. Libau. I was trying to tell me the town that we boarded at. Libau. What they call Libava in Russian. That's a port. I believe it was a Latvian port. I'm not sure. But that was the name. I couldn't think of it at the moment at that time.
How long did your passage over take?
17 days. What a passage. I'll never forget that.
Was it rough?
Well, the roughness, I didn't mind so much. You know, everybody got sick. I was okay. I helped my brother. I helped some of the other people. It was a terrible rough passage. Part of it was the channel, the English channel. But then we got used to it, and I rather enjoyed it. A nice girlfriend who was ailing all through the passage, and I was sort of let her hang onto my arm and take her up on deck.
Were you in a dormitory with a
dormitory girl? Yeah, we were in a dormitory.
And then your brother was?
My brother. We let my brother be on the lower bunk to be with me.
Oh, he was with you in the dormitory then?
Yeah, he was ill, good thing. He suffered terribly. He couldn't get, I guess, for the whole passage.
Did you take your own food with you on the boat?
I took some food, you know, on the boat. They used to give people immigrants dried black bread dipped in beer and with a little sugar or a little cinnamon or something. And they gave me a whole bag full. And I gave it away because people needed it. People were asking for it. So I guess for the first couple of days, I felt it lasted. So I ate well off the table, whatever they were feeding. I was never too a fussy either. I ate everything that was good.
You didn't keep kosher?
I wasn't conscious of it on the boat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then one of my aunts gave us two great big jars, quart jars of currants, jam. And we didn't bother, I wouldn't open it. And as I said, my brother and I were away from the table. But before we were supposed to land, I figured, oh, goodness, we were 17 days on the water. My clothes must be awful. So whatever clothes I had, I changed. And gave it to one of the women who worked there on the boat. I gave it my brother's clothes and my clothes to wash, and she brought me nice and clean. I gave it the boat jazz and jam. I'm so grateful for that. And I guess my aunt never forgave me because my aunt was the one that came to sponsor for us now. And I thought she said, she also gave you some jam. I gave it away. I said, I cleaned up.
Now, did you had to go through Ellis Island?
We did.
Did you have to stay there at all?
No, the aunt and her son came and got us. Of course, it took a day and a night before my aunt and her son convinced them that we're coming to them, that we were not going to be charities. So it took a stayed overnight there. But it wasn't too bad. I rather enjoy the change
from the boat?
From the boat and from the hometown, too.
Mm. Were you frightened about coming over?
No, I wasn't frightened. I'm never frightened when there are a lot of people around. Mm. I figure what happens to one will happen to all.
I mean, just leaving your whole life and everything you know and coming to a
right,
place and not knowing
language? At the moment, when I came here, I was terribly homesick, of course. But the moment of leaving, I didn't feel bad. I mean, I know some of the people, some other people that we watched leaving for America, they were crying, they were hysterical. I didn't feel that way at all. I guess I wasn't sentimental.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the rest of your family then eventually?
Yeah, eventually, we owned a home, big house. So eventually, my father sold a home and took the rest of the children came.
Oh.
Into Boston.
But you, what, your aunt and cousin were in New York?
No, I came, you know, they took us over to the boat I stayed with them about a week or two, and I went on to Canada where my brother was.
I see.
And both my brother and I went on to Canada, and my brother went to the, my young brother went back to school, and I went to work.
So you first started working in Canada?
Yeah, my first landing was near St. John, New Brunswick.
Oh. So you went by boat from New York to Canada?
No, from New York to New Brunswick, went by train.
And what was your first job then?
In the clothing factory. They had a distant relative who was running a what they called suits and cloaks, whatever.
Men's?
Cloak factory. No, women's. Mm-hmm. And we all ended there. It's very nice, that kind of house.
Had you learned how to sew before you left? Did you work at home?
At home, no, I didn't work at home. But we had some dressmakers who were renting a room for my at our house. And I used to watch them sew, and I would ask them for a needle and a thimble, and they were, I was, you know, they'd let me baste and things like that for free. So I knew the rudiments of sewing, but to run an electric machine, I had to learn over there in Canada.
Mm-hmm. How large was that shop?
Well, let me see, it wasn't too large. It was just four or five girls working. There was no union, we didn't know anything about it. So I stayed there until my family, the rest of the family came to Boston.
Well, how come they went to Boston?
Because the rest of the family landed in Boston.
Oh, I see.
So I came there and began to look for a job. And in those days, all you had to do go out in the marketplace in the textile district, and all you'd see is hands wanted, hands wanted. So I went up and said, "Here's the hands."
When was that, Bessie? How long had you stayed in Canada before you went to Boston?
About a year and a half, I guess. And because as long as I knew how to run the sewing machine, an electric sewing machine, it wasn't too hard to get a job. And the first job I got was with a couple of German descended, a couple of sisters who were at a race factory, just shirt makers. Over there at Canada, I was making skirts. So, are you experienced? I said, yes. I started making the waist. I didn't know first thing about it. But the fur lady came around, and she's very, very nice. And she watched me struggle with it. She says, "I guess you never worked at this at place." I says, "No, I was in the skirts." But she was very nice, and we stayed there. So these ladies said, when we hire somebody to work, we don't want them to leave and work a while and go looking for something else. We want to stay. All right. Well, for some reason or other, I would be satisfied. I don't remember whether it was a pay or something. I was satisfied. I had to change my job. So I had to tell her why. I said, "I have to go to my brother's calling me in Canada. I had just come from Canada. Sorry." I went to another job, and I liked better.
What were your work hours like?
The hours were from 8 in the morning till 6, I guess. A half an hour for lunch. 8 till 6.
And what was the shop like?
The shop was pretty good. It was in Boston proper. It was a nice, nice place. But that was in about 1912, when the conference took place, in the Australian League. But I used to hear about it. I used to hear about the strike here, the strike there, the strike in Peppers, New Jersey that I heard about. So I knew what it was all about. But still, I wasn't involved because I didn't, you know, I was only a greenhorn. So this girl that came from Vilna, who came into my neighborhood and her aunt was asking me, do I know the job for her? I said, "Yeah, I'll take her up to where I work because they want help." So the first thing, you know, she's asking me, "There's going to be a mass meeting. Are you going?" I said, "What's a mass meeting? I didn't know. What is that?" Well, she says, "They're going to make a union. They're going to propose a union." I said, "Of course I'll go." So in that way I got acquainted with what was going on.
Well, had your family been revolutionary at all?
No. In a small town, we heard about it. Of course, my oldest brother and sister, I surmised now when I grew up that they were going. You see, at the time, in those years, five, six, I guess, or seven, it was still ferment of the water revolution of 1905. And young people from the city used to come to the towns and open classes for those illiterates. And though my sister and brother were not illiterate then, I mean, but they attended those classes. I surmise that there was organization, propaganda, and it went with the teaching. But as far as the revolutionary, I knew nothing about what I used to hear from the dressmakers. Mm-hmm. I used to hear in the report that, oh, we had such a wonderful meeting in the woods. And then there would be a lookout post, and there would be an alarm. Police are coming. They would scatter.
Now, this was in Boston?
That was in Russia.
Uh-huh.
In Russia. That's how I learned that there's something going on.
Ah.
Yeah. But I didn't know what meant the mass meeting. Imagine that.
That was your first exposure to the idea of unions.
Yeah, when I came to Boston.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Then this girl got me acquainted because her coming from Vilna, from big city, and so she knew more about it. I suppose there's more talk about it among them. Whereas in my town, there wasn't anything. I picked up a book. The only way I learned to read the Russians by finding out what the letters meant, what they were called, and then by putting them together. So I picked this up, titled, How the Bulgars Got Their Freedom, in Russian, the Russian headline. So I started paging and looking at it. So one of the peasants who happened to come in, he says, oh, they'll give you freedom. He read the headline. They'll give you freedom to be received. You know, it's threatening. So that's the only way little by little, that I surmised what was going on. And of course, the 1905 revolution was the 3 days, they gave 3 days freedom of speech, the Tsar declared freedom. And the people flocked to the marketplace. I was just very young and I ran after them. And I heard this young man speaking about this freedom, that even if we get this freedom, that's not enough. And a very handsome young man spoke in Russian. And later on I heard that he was stoned in some village, he was stoned to death. They were so ignorant that the Tsar was there. They referred to the Tsar, the little father Tsar. Little father. And anyone speaking against the Tsar was an enemy. So that's too keen on some of the slogans, some of the songs through those dressmakers. And it's no wonder that the revolution started. I wouldn't say started, but what I mean, they took it and felt it. The people who were sewing with their hands, working with their hands, while their minds were working. They're singing. They sang this song, we're weaving a shroud for the Tsar. I remember hearing them sing that.
Huh.
So you see, they were working and mind was working.
Well, and did you get all this from the dressmakers who lived in your house?
Yes, yes. I heard in all those the meetings they used to have and their experiences with what they call a oblava in Russian. How would you call it? A raid. They all scattered.
But so you were immediately sympathetic to all of this?
Yes, of course. Of course we were. Sometimes we'd hear young people's voices going through the streets, and I'd hear the older ones, oh, those are strikers. Don't pay attention.
So if once they told you what a mass meeting was, then you immediately...
I went with them. We got busy. And the first thing, I guess our strike was 1913.
Were you aware of the Lawrence strike?
Very much so, because through attending the conference of the Venus Trade Union League, it was a national conference.
I remember,
in Boston. If you remember the name, Mrs. Raymond Robbins,
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Dyer,
mm-hmm.
And there was somebody else that impressed me very much, and I just loved their thinking and their expressing what was going on. So in that way, when this conference was over, I went back to work. And somewhere around that time, the Boston Ladies' Waist and Dressmakers struck. And of course, I went with them. I remember working with next to a black little girl. And she was very bright. And I liked her, and I thought we talked to her a lot. But when she wouldn't come out on strike, I was so disappointed. And I just, it hurt me. How come Ella didn't go out?
What was the nationality of most of the people where you worked?
I think mostly Yiddish at that time, Jewish immigrants' children. And there were some native Bostonians that wouldn't hear of the union. Why, a union was an animal? It's a foreign thought, and we don't want it.
So it was very difficult to organize those?
Very difficult. I don't know how, but I'll give you an example. In this place where I worked, after the strike, it was settled, I still didn't come back to work at that place because it happened to be at the same time a strike in a small town in Massachusetts of children's dressmakers who wanted to join the IWW. And when I heard about the difference between AFL unions, IWW unions, I figured it's more reasonable to have an industry-wide union. So I went with them. And I went over to Malden, I helped them with the strike there. I helped them one way or another, whatever I could. So, of course, I lost that other job. So this time, I got a job, and the day was through, I got a job at a smaller place. And there was one particular garment that was awfully difficult, and they felt there wasn't enough, not enough money in it. But they wouldn't, neither one would go to speak to the boss about it. So I suggested, I said, at that time there was a headquarters that the Women's Trade Union League had, not too far from where we worked, where our shop was. I suggested, let's all go up, I said, there, and talk it over. So they all came. But join a union, oh no. They all came and they put me up as a spokesman. I'm not much of a spokesman, but nobody would dare to go to Boston. So I told them, we decided that we have to have more money for that garment. Couldn't make it. So he was very angry. Why didn't you come to me first? I didn't know. I didn't know how you would take it or something. We had to talk it over. Anyway, he was angry. He must have given us a raise on that. But they wouldn't go to the bullet. It was most Native American.
Ah.
And a union, no. It's for foreigners.
Now, was there all the shirt waist makers?
Right.
Was the union already existing, or was the women in Boston, or was the women...
They were just organizing. The only way that they could organize the trade was by declaring a strike. In that way, they would somehow get together. It would touch everyone.
So the strike was actually to organize the
shop. To organize the shop.
It wasn't that they were already organized and they were calling a strike.
No, it was to organize the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some capable girls who were working very hard at it, and he managed to organize, because there's a lot of, as I said, Native Americans that wouldn't join the union, but some of them did. And
what was the role of the Women's Trade Union League?
Well, they were organizing. Their role was to organize the workers and to emphasize that in union there is strength. I remember they had a march in Boston. The slogans went like, let them walk on the carpet, don't let them walk over you, something like that. I know they were carpet makers of some kind. That was the attempt that they were making to organize the unorganized workers.
Now, how did you feel? They were mainly middle-class, non-working women who were the ones in the Women's Trade Union League. How did you feel about them coming in to organize the working?
Some people in New York, what I used to hear about it, they felt terrible. They were angry at those women who came up, you know, the wealthy people who came to organize the poor workers. But as for myself, because I've met those women and I heard them speak, and it was to my liking, it was like-minded. So I respected them.
Mm-hmm.
I liked them.
Now, did you ever join the Wobbly? You said that you were more successful.
Well, I did. I certainly did join the Wobbly. Well, we couldn't join the Wobblies because our union was organized with the AFL. But this union in Malden, four young men came from New York to organize the textile. And we also had an organizer, a paid organizer, who was trying to organize textile workers and the needle trade. But it didn't go with the needle trade, except for a small group of raincoat makers joined the IWW. And my group, I got acquainted with more people. And they weren't belonging to any trade. They were more or less here and there, different things that they were doing for a living. But they weren't in any trade. But we were all for the IWW idea, so we organized into a propaganda league.
Was this a new group of friends?
This group of friends are immediate friends that we had. They were a group of young boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were older, some people that... Once they were the organizers at Propaganda League. One was a bricklayer, and I remember the bricklayer. I don't remember the others, what they did.
Were you all anarchists?
We what?
Were you all anarchists? Or you were just No.
We weren't anarchists. The Wobblies were not anarchists either. They just wanted a stronger organization like their preamble of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But we... The workers and the bosses and the employers are completely, their interests are completely different. And you can't expect any cohesion between you. And that made sense to me too. So that's what we were working at, and what we try to do is join more people to our group, Propaganda League, and also, the trade union people, if we could get them, okay. Some of them did come in.
And then what were your goals of the league?
To get as many people as possible from the trade, they should organize them into IWW unions, which is industrialized union.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the CIO grew out of that.
Right. So you formed this propaganda league to just, at first, to bring in more people, but
right.
The goal was to organize
the trade into industrial unions. That was our goal.
Mm-hmm.
But then the war broke out, the First World War, and they all went their ways. For instance, we had a couple who felt very deeply of British origin. They went back to Britain to help with the war effort. Just a few perhaps some of them lost their jobs because of the IW activities. So then, of course, 1915, I got married and I sort of dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
But
were you in any other political groups besides the Propaganda League?
Well, I was in the union, in the Race Makers Union. I didn't take an active part, but I paid my dues and then faithfully did meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And help them, of course, whenever there was anything to be done, like raising money, I was there to help right there.
But you weren't involved with the Socialist Party or with the
Socialist Party, no. My husband wasn't. He was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be one of the young socialists, what they called themselves then. I forget now. But he was in a group.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, and after being with me and my friends, he sort of drifted over to IWW too.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it made much sense.
Now, what effect did you were opposed to the war then when it started, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely I was opposed to the war.
Were you involved in any activities against the war?
I wouldn't even buy any war saving stamps. I didn't, I was very, very opposed to it. I knew that it was none of the workers' war. And of course I had a baby, but my husband, he was very much involved with anti-war work, my husband and my brother. So...
What did your husband do?
He was in the shoe business a little bit. again, you know, he didn't belong to any trade because he was in business.
Mm-hmm.
And the IWW had nothing to do with business people. Mm-hmm. So they had to be workers. Yeah, we had a very nice organizer there in Boston. You know, he protested the war by not wearing a necktie, I remember that.
What was the meaning of that supposed to be?
Mourning, I guess. Uh-huh. Mourning for the dead. Like during the Vietnam War, my husband wouldn't wear a necktie at all. If he put on a necktie, sometimes it would be a black one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard of the black, I mean, we used to wear the black armbands, but I never heard of not wearing the necktie.
Yeah, well, he wore the black necktie when it was necessary for a necktie.
Mm-hmm. You were married in 1915?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then when was your first child born?
My child was born in 16.
Mm-hmm.
Middle year of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved away from the city. That was the main problem, that I dropped out of the movement until later when they were a little bit bigger. I could leave him home with my husband and go to a meeting. So, as I said, we lived about 12 or 13 miles away from the city. And if I should want to go to a meeting, I had no way of coming home because the last train was 10:15. Who could leave a meeting before 11 o'clock? So I just had to drop out. But later, when I heard, you know, that during the Cold War, I heard of the Friends of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
That's the revolution there. I used to go into a meeting. By then I was driving a car, so I used to go in.
This was in the mid-20s?
That was
the Friends of the Soviet Union.
Then we'll be old, you must let me think. Yeah, it must have been in the later 20s that I could go out. Because
mm-hmm.
my last child was born in 1923.
Mm-hmm. How many children did you have?
Three. So I used to go, you know, I wanted to know what's going on. So that was my experience.
So from the time you quit the shop in 1915.
Right.
And then you weren't very involved in rifle activities until...
Well, there wasn't, until I could get out, mm-hmm. until it was possible to go into the city and
mm-hmm.
raise the kids. We didn't have any babysitters like people mm-hmm. we have now. In fact, you know, during the war, when I was suggesting to my husband that I ought to go back to work because girls were making money.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, if you stay home, I'll go to work. If you go to work, I'll stay home. Because we had a child like that.
Mm-hmm. But that didn't work out?
No, even though his mother lived with us too, but he wouldn't think of leaving the child with
uh-huh.
anyone else but a parent.
So did you finally go back to work or
no? I did not, no.
Uh-huh.
That was that.
That was that. And did you ever join the Communist Party or just the
No.
Plunter
I knew a lot of people who were very good, wonderful friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go occasionally to open meetings, attended one or two classes, Marxist classes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about all.
Well, what groups did you belong to after the Friends of the Soviet Union just lasted a short time, didn't it?
Well, it lasted for a while. Then we had this record, the Birbidjan episode, where at the time of Stalin's writing about nationalities, he thought that he assigned a place that if the Jewish people wanted to settle there, they were welcome and, as a territory, and then eventually they could run it themselves, it would be an entity. But it didn't work out. So we worked for them. Some people did go there. We helped out. We used to enjoy going to the meetings there.
Were you considering going back?
Not
ever?
Me. No, no. No, we had our roots here. But I did know people who went and stayed for a few years and came back. They couldn't take it. They
mm-hmm.
said it was too rough. For instance, a family went over. We took them to a certain destination, like to Bridgeport, where they boarded a train for New York. They were going to, he was a pastry cook,
mm-hmm.
and he and his family were going to Birbidjan. And they said, no matter, they're not coming back. They're going to stay and make it go. Well, They didn't stay there. I don't know how long they were there. I don't remember. But they had unfortunate experience. One of their daughters, they lost one of their daughters during the trip. And they didn't need him at that time in the Regina pastry cook. Apparently he couldn't find work. Well, he came back. They came back as a family. But he must have been pretty well broken up because we never saw the family again.
Now, you earlier mentioned a friend that was deported after the Palmer raid.
Yeah, this friend, I don't remember her second name. There was she and the two sisters who were deported. And the rest of the family stayed there in Boston.
Were they involved in IWW?
Well, they were involved because this girlfriend of mine who is dead now, she was very much involved with me. I have some pictures that we took at the strike where there was a Greek person speaking. Apparently there's a lot of Greek people involved in that particular industry, hose making, you know, stockings, weaving. It was outside of town. I remember this girl vividly. We went up to listen to the speakers. So we were involved in that. But of course the other girl wouldn't commit herself, this other friend of mine. She thought, and a lot of people that I knew, a lot of them were for the IWW, but they stayed at their work. And now for instance, to give you an example, these girls who were involved in children's dressmaker strike, they wanted to organize them. So this young man and my very best friend who was sort of teaching me, she's a little older than I am. And they called a meeting in Boston, the Raincoat Makers headquarters. So we three were the organizers. And the girls came, and it came to speak for them. What was it, why they were called, what was it about? So the girl got laryngitis, she lost her voice. And the young man, I don't know why, he wouldn't speak up. So they put me out. And I'm very poor in coordination because I had no training, I had no schooling. And some people just have the inborn ability to speak up, but I never did. So in short, I have to explain them why we're here and in very short terms that the IWW is better than the AFL for the workers. And they did organize a union there in Molden. And I, because of that, they called me and I went. I left my other job and I went.
So
I stayed with them for quite a while.
So you were really an organizer for the IWW?
I was not. I wouldn't call myself an organizer at all because I couldn't speak up.
Mm.